In the end, the social welfare model relies on a form of trust. It seems people are more willing to withstand high rates of taxation if they know that their taxes are paying for programs that help people like them. Because poor people in the social welfare states are of the same cultural and ethnic background as the rest of the population, it is politically easier to promote programs that support the poor. The social welfare model underlines how important it is for the success of the welfare state that citizens identify with the beneficiaries of government programs. They are less likely to do so if socioeconomic divisions coincide with racial or ethnic divisions. This is a central point. The costs of racism are great. Racial and ethnic diversity in the United States, and in many countries in Latin America, has led to divided and unequal societies. It has also contributed to the failure of the welfare state. In order to combat poverty and inequality in those racially divided societies, it is also essential to combat racism and intolerance. Further reflections on the United States. The oddest fact about U.S. politics in the past quarter century is that income inequalities have widened considerably. The number of families living in poverty has stopped declining. The size of the prison population is sky-high. The underclass has become even less socially mobile than before. And yet American politics has increasingly favored the rich. In hefty tax cuts, reduced outlays for the poor, the lack of progress on expanded health care coverage, and much more. Democracy has not brought home the benefits for the bulk of the population, but instead has favored the super-rich. Yet perhaps none of this is surprising, since the heightened inequality of income has also been accompanied by an even more ruthless penetration of big money into national politics. The cross-country evidence that we've just reviewed puts to rest the false proposition that the growing income inequality in the United States is the inevitable price to pay for a highly productive economy. The social welfare states enjoy high productivity and a much greater economic fairness and with much less poverty. While there is no doubt that the U.S. super-rich are benefiting in terms of personal wealth and mega-consumption, there is no evidence that the rest of the population has been a beneficiary of the strategy of stingy social outlays. One of the best books on U.S. politics in recent years is The 2% Solution by Matthew Miller, who shows how little it would take to make a big difference in addressing the needs of the U.S. poor. Even without going all the way to a social welfare strategy, the United States could smooth the hard edges of American inequality, just as increased rich country help could make a huge difference among the world's poor. Miller's title refers to the idea that 2% of U.S. national income, if devoted to increased social outlays, could address some of the profound inequities of U.S. society, especially the lack of universal health coverage, which it would require less than 1% of national income in added spending to ensure, and the poor quality of public schools for the children of U.S. poor and working-class families. It is important to note that President George W. Bush's tax cuts, which went overwhelmingly to the rich, amount to around 2% of national income each year. The Iraq War costs roughly 1% of national income each year in direct outlays. Thus, by reversing the tax cuts and ending the Iraq War, it would be possible to pay more for the U.S. poor, to ensure, for example, universal health care coverage within the United States, and to improve public schools, while also increasing U.S. outlays for the world's poor to the 0.7% of U.S. GNP that we promised. Another recent and powerful book is Jacob Hacker's The Great Risk Shift, which describes how the United States not only lacks an adequate social insurance system today, but has also substantially dismantled the limited system that was in place during the past 40 years, with the peak years of social insurance identified as the mid-1960s, during Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty. Hacker demonstrates the great rise in risk facing the American middle class, as well as the poor, and shows the remarkably high proportion of the middle class in the United States who are vulnerable to spells of poverty. He describes vividly and persuasively how a great right-wing attack on social insurance has systematically reduced the scope of the social welfare system in healthcare, job protection, child support, housing support, and retirement security. He recounts all that is misguided about the constricted philosophy of self-help and market-based solutions that has dominated U.S. politics in recent years. our framework of social protection is overwhelmingly focused on the aged, even though young adults and families with children face the greatest economic strains. It emphasizes short-term exits from the workforce, even though long-term job losses and the displacement and obsolescence of skills have become more severe. It embodies, in places, the antiquated notion that family strains can be dealt with by a second earner, usually a woman, who can easily leave the workforce when there is a need for a parent at home. Above all, it is based on the idea that job-based private insurance can easily fill the gaps left by public programs, when it is ever more clear that it cannot. There are five main conclusions to our investigation of social insurance in the United States and abroad. The United States does not have to accept continued high rates of poverty as the price to pay for a vibrant market economy, since social insurance can be combined with a high-productivity market economy. The United States does not have to choose between its own poor and the world's poor. It can help both, at modest cost, and with budgetary funding sources that are easy to identify. The United States can learn from the success stories of social welfare states how to foster a greater degree of social harmony and confidence in public institutions. The U.S. social insurance system is even more tattered than it looks because of the increased variability of incomes and risks facing American households. The costs of major corrections are small relative to U.S. national income. Those lessons, of course, can be applied beyond the United States to other high-income countries as well, and can be guideposts for middle-income countries on their way to high-income status. Our focus on the United States is due, in no small part, to the fact that the United States, uniquely among the world's high-income countries, has carried on a decades-long assault on social insurance in a manner contrary to the evidence and with increasingly adverse results.